Support for Access Utah comes from the Utah Humanities Council, enriching cultural, intellectual, and civic life by providing opportunities for all Utahns to explore life's most engaging questions and the wonders of the human experience.
Welcome to Access Utah. This is Sherry Quinn. Imagine a future where you don't have to stop for gas when driving across the country. Researchers at Utah State University's Energy Dynamics Laboratory in Logan are working on such a solution using what's called wireless power transfer. Local, national, and world leaders in electric vehicle technology gathered in Park City Thursday and Friday to take this technology forward. According to Jeff Moos, conference chair and president of the Energy Dynamics Lab, the U.S. needs to invest more in this new transportation infrastructure.
Quite frankly, a lot of folks in Europe and the Asia-Pacific region are moving very quickly in this space, and so it's an impetus on the United States and on our federal government and the private sector to sort of keep pace, and it's not easy.
Moos added that the first applications of wireless power will likely be in transit systems, such as city buses and taxis, that go to the same locations frequently, but don't have the luxury of plugging in for a battery charge. Joining us on the program today is John Boyce, professor of electronics at the University of Auckland in New Zealand. He is referred to as the pioneer of what's called inductive power transfer. This up-and-coming technology allows vehicles to receive electric power from roads, eliminating the need to fuel up or charge a battery.
I catch a bus to work, which is very green, and I catch a bus home, and in between times I walk a lot and I think about things, and I do scientific and engineering things. I've always been interested in how things work and what makes things go and all that sort of thing, so engineering was a natural thing for me to want to do. Electrical engineering, well, I didn't know anything about it and it seemed the most challenging, so I thought I'd do that. So that's how I got into it. And then this particular aspect of inductively coupled electric vehicles, well, that was a problem that came up, and so I've done some work on that over some time now.
Why were you passionate about engineering?
Oh, that's a bit hard. I mean, why do I love my wife type of thing? I like electrical engineering. It's just how things work, and it's the engineers create the built environment that we live in. And I like to live in a nice environment. I don't like topsy-turvy environments. And so I like engineering because we create a better environment. So with the architects and the engineers, engineers are the people that create all the buildings, all the roading infrastructure, everything. So it's a wonderful thing to be an engineer.
And what is your goal with this technology?
With the electrical vehicle technology, we're heading into a time where gasoline prices are continuing to escalate and become more scarce. And so we need something where our cities can continue to function. And our cities are based to a very large extent on private transportation, particularly in the United States. So the ability to continue to have private transformation at an economic price that everyone can afford is severely at risk with current vehicles and current fuel pricing policies. And that's something where electric vehicles, I believe, really do have a role to play. So I'm interested in that as a possible solution.
What countries are best suited for this technology, for these electric vehicles and the electric roadways?
I think all countries are suited to some extent. Certainly the United States is suited. The problem with our conventional fuels are that as China and India come online and start to use gasoline, then the demand on our gasoline prices, our gasoline reserves, is going to go up quite enormously. And so this problem is not something that we can put off. We are probably past peak oil now, and so oil is going to continue to be a diminishing resource. And the United States uses a lot of oil, so if the United States can cut its present oil uptake, then it's going to be very good for the United States. So I think the US has one of the biggest things to gain from going into this particular technology. At the present time, the UK, is particularly in London, is probably the most EV-friendly city in the world. They have congestion charges in London and parking restrictions and all sorts of things. All of these are waived for electric vehicles. So it's really a good thing to buy an electric vehicle there, because you can charge and you can take it places and it doesn't cost you anything apart from just the cost of running the vehicle. So I think that's the number one at the present time. And New Zealand is a long way behind some of the other countries, but there is an interest in New Zealand, and I can only say that I hope that New Zealand will come on board.
And it's quite expensive. Can you talk about the cost of transferring, say, 10% of the technology?
Nobody knows what the price is going to be, because it's a question of prototype vehicles at the present time, leading on to commercial mass production at a later stage. But the signs are there that this can be a cheaper technology than present gasoline vehicles, and nothing else can be. Hydrogen certainly won't be cheaper than gasoline. At the present time, there are a number of organisations around the world that are trying to set standards for electric vehicles. We just hope that they're getting good advice and using it so that the regulatory standards that they come up with are functionally what we need to make these vehicles economical and functional in the world we're heading into.
And can you talk about your collaboration with the USU and the Energy Dynamics Lab and how that came about, and what you're currently working on together?
Well, we have an interest in electric vehicles, and USU has an interest in the application of our roads to carry much higher roading traffic density. And if they're going to get higher traffic density, then they need to automate the roads a lot more. And automation of roads and electric vehicles are things that are naturally, well, they naturally go together. So it's in their interest and our interest that the electric vehicles should be used, and that they should be used more efficiently. And I know that Jeff's group with PREA is looking to increase the traffic densities on our roads by up to a factor of 3 times, which is huge.
For instance, semi-trucks. Will semi-trucks be able to be powered by these roadways?
We don't know. I think it's difficult to see how the great big 42-wheelers are going to be powered by them at the present time. And they may well continue to be powered with conventional fuel. But a huge amount of gasoline is used by small vehicles. And even if we can just start at the bottom and work up, then we're still going to start making a dent in what's happening.
How much progress can be made in the next several years?
I'm probably too optimistic to be realistic about this, but I think that within the next 10 years, we will see a significant move in electric vehicles in our societies. And I think that once they become established, people will like them so much that they won't ever want to go back.
Will it require that most of the major highways are converted, or most roadways?
Well, if you're taking the United States, if people had charging at home and charging at work and charging on the freeways, and especially the interstates, which we don't have in New Zealand, but here the interstates are only 1% of the roading, but they carry about 22% of the traffic. So by having those where cars can drive and be charged as they go, probably with the garages at home and charging at work, then probably 60 to 70% of the requirements for charging are already in existence, if you can just do that.
What are the biggest challenges right now that you're facing with the technology and getting other countries on board?
I think the biggest technology is a chicken and egg, that you can't run electric vehicles until you have electric roads, and there's no economic justification for electric roads until you've got electric vehicles. So that is a significant problem, but probably the way to solve that is to start small and just build it up with some small fleet vehicles like taxis to begin with, or delivery trucks or FedEx trucks or something like that. And as they build up, then gradually we can end up with more roads being instrumented and more use of it, and it can grow from there. I think that we live in a society where our living conditions are important to us, and air quality is a major one. And air quality can definitely be improved by electric vehicles. And then there's the way that we function in our cities. There's noise as well, which is dramatically improved by electric vehicles. There's the convenience factor, that you don't have to stop at garages all the time and or petrol stations and refill. There's just a huge number of things that we take it for granted now, that with internal combustion engines, that's what you have to do. But those would disappear with electric motor-driven cars. And as they disappear, We would think, gosh, why didn't we do this ages ago? So I think it's going to be one of those things that once it starts happening, it will continue to happen. For example, just about everyone I know uses an electric toothbrush. Now, you don't have to have an electric toothbrush, but once you've used an electric toothbrush, you don't really want to go back to your old toothbrush because it just makes such a nicer job of cleaning your teeth.
Jeff Moos is president of the Energy Dynamics Laboratory and chair of the International Conference. He orchestrated this meeting comprised of electric vehicle technology leaders from industry, academia, and local and federal government, representing 8 countries from across the world.
This conference is targeting sort of a new group of people interested in extending the range of electric vehicles. Through a new method, instead of focusing on improving batteries, for example, the idea is to electrify roadways. And it's really built around challenging the premise that vehicles have to carry all of their energy around with them. And the enabling technology that goes along with that is wireless power transfer. So it may be possible in the future to have our vehicles actually get their power from the roadway as they travel down the highways. People are beginning to recognize that wireless power is a transformative technology that has the potential to sort of change the way we view vehicle transportation. And so more and more industry folks have made announcements in the last year relative to new results and demonstrations. More research universities have gotten involved, also again with new results. There's also been a standards committee that's been formed that's headed up by one of the large auto manufacturers in Europe. And if you sort of combine all of those things together, there's sort of a new wave of interest in electric vehicles tied around this concept of electrified roadways.
And why now?
Why now? In the case of the United States, is we import a lot of oil. We have a lot of emissions. We have air quality issues in some of our cities. And so if we can take the sort of the combustion portion of electrification at power plants out of the city centers, we can improve air quality in cities, and we can, you know, do many of the things that we're unable to do with sort of conventional approaches.
And you mentioned that some of the challenges are is it safe and durable and
right.
efficient, and can you address those?
Yes, and so right now the Standards Committee from the Society of Automotive Engineering is addressing all those issues. Generally what we're finding is that this technology is just as safe as, say, an inductively powered toothbrush, which many people have in their bathrooms. The standards for emissions that have been set in Europe and the United States are both things that are being addressed or topics that are being addressed by these standards committees, and they're basically ensuring that whatever this technology does in terms of being used does not sort of exceed those requirements that are set for all types of industries, not just electric vehicles.
Funding for growing this new infrastructure in the U.S. is harder to come by than in places such as Europe and Asia.
Around the world, probably hundreds of millions of dollars have been, private capital has now gone into wireless power, most of it for stationary applications. I think that here in the United States, it's probably, you know, order of magnitude less than that. Quite frankly, a lot of folks in Europe and the Asia-Pacific region are moving very quickly in this space, and so it's an impetus on the United States and on our federal government and the private sector to sort of keep pace, and it's not easy.
Kurt Roberts is Associate Vice President of Commercialization and Regional Development at Utah State University. He works with USU researchers to help spin their projects into business opportunities.
We're really excited about it because we think it really is the first time we're seeing something that has the potential to power our transportation without having to use carbon fuels. It really is revolutionary in its potential to get power into buses, cars, transport vehicles of various kinds in a way that is really incredibly economical.
And how does the university support the research financially and in terms of academics and research?
The research is done in our research foundation, and in that organization we have various teams that work on different kinds of projects. This is one that we've really decided to prioritize because we feel the potential is so great. The funding that we use for this project includes some funding we had from the Department of Energy that got us started down this path. And then we've also decided to make this team one of our USTAR teams. So we are using some of the state of Utah funding that we get in the USTAR program to support this research also.
How challenging is this one compared to the other projects in terms of supporting and commercial viability?
Commercializing in this technology is a little bit unique because there are places where it can really work well and there are places where it's much harder. If what you're talking about is trying to put electricity in roadways all over the world and have the ability, for example, to get on the freeway and have the freeway transferring power to your car as you drive, that is an extraordinarily long-term proposition and extraordinarily expensive. On the other hand, if your objective is to take, let's say, a bus route, where a bus is repeating the same cycle over and over again during the course of a day, and is always stopped at the same places at predictable times, you can put the electrical charging in those locations only, fairly inexpensively, and have a system that is less expensive to operate and in all the costs less expensive than natural gas, diesel, full electric, basically any other mechanism you can use to power that bus.
How do you go beyond USTO, beyond Utah, beyond the country?
Fortunately, there is a ton of interest around the world for this technology. The team, for example, in Auckland, New Zealand, that really has pioneered much of the research in this area is the team from which we acquired our lead researcher, a man named Hunter Wu. He worked for that team in Auckland and was really trained and educated down there. And you have, we have people here from the Korea Advanced Institute of Science and Technology, KAIST. They're investing an enormous amount of resource in research in this area. So the beauty is, we're not the only ones that are interested in this. There are various organizations around the world that are putting time and energy and resources in their best creative minds to solving the technical challenges. And so we don't have to solve them all. We just have to be one part of the solution.
And can you talk about that part of the solution?
Yeah, what we think we do best is we have figured out a way to transfer very high amounts of power over larger air gaps than was previously possible. One of the reasons this technology has been hard to adopt is because the source of the power and the receiver of the power had to be extraordinarily close together. Think of something like your electric toothbrush. It had to be very close together, almost touching. What we've been able to accomplish is to transfer very, very large amounts of power over air gaps that are 10 to 12 inches wide. So a typical bus or a vehicle or whatever can pull into a location where it stops to load or unload passengers, and the driver doesn't have to get out and do anything special or position the vehicle in a particularly precise way. Our technology allows that power to be transferred even if the bus isn't exactly where it needs to be to pick up that power.
And so have you seen a lot of interest here then?
There's a lot of interest here. I think the wonderful thing we've seen that's really validated by this conference, this is our first year. We had hoped we would have a lot of interest both nationally and internationally. It's exceeded our expectations. We had substantially more people here at the conference than we thought we would have. And I think there's so much dialogue going on about the different types of breakthroughs that the various people around the world are making in this. And there certainly is a substantial interest in what we've been able to accomplish at USU.
Can you talk about the cost of the project? And I imagine that's changing.
Yeah, the cost is changing. It's entirely dependent upon, at any given time, about the breadth of the research that we have going on. Currently, we have a full-time team of three people, three scientists that are on the project. And those scientists use students and other resources also that gives gives them additional leverage and also gives the students an opportunity to work on something that's really breakthrough. There's, of course, a facility that that they work in, and there's very specialized equipment and supplies and things that have to be used in the prototyping and the research that they do. It's expensive research. I mean, we're in seven-figure budgets to do this kind of work. But in the context of research that's done in biotechnology, drug development, that sort of thing, it's actually amazingly inexpensive to do this kind of work.
And has the DOE's position or support changed over the course of the year? And have they gotten more enthusiastic about it, or has that been a little bit of a challenge?
I think what we're finding from the federal government, and our situation is not unique, I think all researchers are finding this, is that the state of the federal budget and federal finances are so precarious that many, many research programs, not just wireless power transfer, but many research programs are sort of holding back, trying to figure out what money they'll ultimately have and how much support they'll ultimately have in the federal budget to be able to fund research. So we are definitely seeing the Department of Energy more cautious, and that's one of the reasons why we're putting as much emphasis in commercial development as we are, because we're not willing to count exclusively on the federal government's willingness to continue to fund this.
So that with the wireless power transfer technology and the breakthrough in being able to power from a much larger air gap, what's the commercial viable part of that? Is it a patent that can be drawn from the innovation?
Yes, we filed a few patent applications on this, on the innovation that we've created already. The researchers, of course, continue to improve this, and we already know of additional things they've created that we have not yet put in patent applications. But we are constantly preparing for additional patent applications associated with the work that they've done. So we filed three patent applications with that work within the past few months, and anticipate that in the coming months there will be several more to come. I just think people should be excited about what we have here in the state of Utah, and should really appreciate the research capabilities that exist at Utah State and the things that the amazing scientists we have there and the things that they're able to invent. It really is it's a treasure for Utah.
For Access Utah, this is Sherry Quinn. Stay tuned for Science Questions, up next.
I'm an engine driver on a long run, on a long run.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crumb Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Support for Science Questions comes from USU's College of Science, advancing the educational experience of future scientists with advanced research in the lab, field, and outer space. When students and faculty learn together, discovery follows. Information is at usu.edu/science.
Welcome to Science Questions. I'm Sherry Quinn.
And I am Susie Montgomery. For most of us, no matter how far removed, the words back to school conjure up strong and lingering images. Stiff new threads, new shoes, blazers and plaid, the crunch of crisp leaves, cooler nights, and the anticipation of new commitments. A fall fresh start. This week, Science Questions is going back to school and heralding two exceptional science teachers who are doing far more than just dusting off the old textbooks.
If ever around Salt Lake City you spotted a large yellow biodiesel school bus conducted by a slight, curly-headed woman, or you witnessed this same teacher using her large voice to solicit vegetable donations for school lunches at the local farmers market, then you have been privy to Slixie biology teacher Shay Wilkelson. She and her middle school elective biology class
are busy blending up various school lunches and fast food happy meals, tracing the carbon content and testing for corn in everyday food to determine the origins and health issues surrounding these conveniently tasty meals. Slixy 10th grader Josh explains.
High corn diets are directly linked to obesity, diabetes, and high blood pressure. And if students today are favoring high corn diets, then we could see an increase in these diseases.
If we are what we eat, what are we? Wickelson asks. An essential question for this project called Untangling the Food Web. The project got underway last fall with students investigating and mapping the food, specifically fruit, in their environment.
Peppers, cherries,
crab apples,
plums.
Oh yeah, crab apples.
We're trying to identify the amount of fruit-bearing plants in our neighborhoods.
Okay, and so what did you do to do that?
I started at the end of my street, walked 4 blocks down Davis Boulevard, and counted all the apple trees and all the edible plants I could see.
I'm Jacob Robinson, and I found a flowering plum. A plum that isn't planted for the fruit, it's planted for the beauty of it during the spring. And I believe I found some apricots down the road and some tomatoes possibly across the street.
My name's Anna.
Okay, what'd you find, Anna?
I found peppers, carrots, pumpkins, tomatoes, apples, apricots, plums, and pears.
A food web ecologically is, of course, all the organisms in a given community that eat each other, that eat, you know, plants, that get eaten by other things, that get broken down by decomposers. But the human food web is so big and so complicated now that our community is generally the entire globe. Different parts of your food can come from all over, and it's increasingly really hard to actually track and trace and to measure our impact. The fruit in your neighborhood is something that's fairly easy to track compared to where we get a lot of our food, and it's a good time of year to track it. It's also a good chance to introduce terms like transects and taking population data, and right now we're just working on understanding the scientific method and writing conclusions and graphing data and those kinds of things.
Wilkerson had the students tracking, graphing, and picking fruit, not only to develop their rudimentary skills in executing the scientific method, but to orient them in their community. They became neighborhood distributors of fruit, supplying fellow schoolmates, community members, and the food bank. As the project moved along and the fall fruit gave way to winter, the students teamed up with University of Utah scientist mentors. After school, they would hit the lab at the U of U to work, furthering their understanding of the composition and origins of the food we eat. One of the projects, conceived by two ninth grade girls, looked at the health discrepancies between natural grass-fed cows and industrial corn-fed cows. The latter, the cause of some serious health issues.
Cows are actually physiologically designed to eat grass, not corn. So when cows eat corn, they tend to have different problems. They need more antibiotics. This is where E. coli, the bad E. coli, actually evolved, was in this corn cow stomach environment.
Middle schoolers Jade and Jasmina took to the tedious task of determining whether the beef labeled grass-fed was really grass-fed. First, they did a little research. Jasmina explains their project they called What's Really in Your Beef, Getting Down to the Isotope.
While you're raising something industrially, you're using growth hormones, synthetic chemicals, all sorts of things that make it less healthy. So your health benefits tend to decrease. So with grass-fed beef, you have more omega-3 fatty acids than you would in the industrial beef. As well as studies have shown that with the grass-fed beef, it's better for your immune system. And industrial beef, it's being fed corn, so that means that you're eating a beef that has been eating corn. And corn is linked with conditions like diabetes and high blood pressure.
Looking at different carbon isotopes in the beef, such as carbon-12 and carbon-13, would tell them what the cow had been eating, where detection of C-13 would indicate the cow was a corn eater.
So in order to test this experiment, we got 12 different beef samples, six of which were labeled to be grass-fed and six were industrial-raised. And we got our samples and we had to freeze dry them with liquid nitrogen in order to get them ready for the vacuum. And when we put them in the vacuum took out all the liquid, so then we can later on grind them and get them ready for a mass spectrometer. And after we got them out of the vacuum, we had to add in more liquid nitrogen in order to be able to grind them into a fine powder. And then we took 0.5 micrograms of each sample and put them into tiny tin capsules that then we had to combust, because in order for your mass spectrometer to get a carbon reading, it has to be in a vapor. So the vapor would enter into the mass spectrometer and it would hit an electron beam, and the electron beam would shoot electrons at your sample. So then your sample would become a positively charged ion, which would then accelerate towards an electromagnet, and the electromagnet would then change the trajectory of the samples. So the heavier ones would come closer in towards the magnet, and the lighter ones, so carbon-12, would go farther out. And at the end, you have little plates that read how many times an atom has hit it. Then you get a reading of how much carbon-13 and 12 is in each sample.
The results showed how Smith's, Whole Foods, and Tony Caputo's compared.
This color, the red, is the Smith's grocery store. And what was interesting with that is that the organic beef, what it says it was labeled organic, but it wasn't grass-fed. So not always does organic mean grass-fed. It means that the corn it was eating was organic. And also, the ones from Whole Foods are labeled, they have a rating system, 1 through 5. 1 being that it doesn't meet the Whole Foods standards, and 5 being it is pasture-raised, grass-fed, and all-natural. And that shows on the graph that they were telling the truth with that. And
another thing, the beef samples we got from Tony Caputo's, one of them rated the highest for eating C3 plants. So that means that you're getting really good grass-fed cows as well as local cows. So then you have two benefits right there.
At Tony Caputo's food market in Delhi in downtown Salt Lake City, we caught up with Matt Caputo, son of Tony Caputo, behind the counter. He is the marketing director and aficionado of cheese, olive oil, and all other fine Italian specialties.
The reason why we don't just go with one is because we're talking about small farmers who don't have enough available all the time to keep us in constant stock. However, when people come in and want to shop here at Caputo's, they came in wanting ground beef, or they came in wanting New York strip loin, or you know, something like that. They have to be able to find what they came in here for. But it's important to us to be able to deal with these smaller farmers who we have the opportunity to go out to their places, visit them, see what they're doing, talk to them about their practices, and really, to me, it's in the end, it's all about flavor and what that connecting to that flavor of, you know, how things tasted hundreds of years ago. I think it's a much richer experience, both just for gustatory enjoyment and, you know, for as a cultural practice too. So I think one of my strongest assets as a buyer here is the fact that I've been around the block a long time. I look young, and I'm only 31 years old, but you know, I've been in the specialty food business literally since I was 5. And before that, my dad and our family, in fact, there was a Caputo store in Rose Park. I think they wrapped up shop probably in the 60s or thereabouts, but they were the first refrigerated deli case in Utah. They were a little back in the days where food was purchased at your corner store instead of at a mass supermarket and things like that. So it just feels like it's been in our blood.
And Matt says you don't have to be an expert to taste the difference in quality between the meat sold at Caputo's versus grocery store meats.
Any person on earth, regardless of their experience in meat, they don't have to have some expert palate. If they take home a packet of Kirkland hamburgers and take home some of that ground beef from Pleasant Creek Ranch, say, and do the exact same treatment of both things, all you have to be is alive to be able to be bowled over by the difference. It is a big, big, big difference flavor-wise. What I really get a thrill on is taking people who aren't even part of this food culture necessarily and who are interested in it but are kind of a little bit intimidated by it, and inviting them into it and showing them the difference in a way that's not elitist, that's not like, oh, I'm a connoisseur and I love this to lord my knowledge over everyone. That's not at all what it's about. And I think that's what kind of sets our staff apart and why we're able to make these picks and connect with people on these products, whether it's beef or cheese or whatever, is because we do it from a place of passion and wanting to be inclusive. If they wander in here, we want to share with them. It's a great, you know, confirmation of what we're trying to do here, and not just in the fact that we won, but the fact that there's two ninth graders that came up with this study. And I think that in itself is the true victory. I think the fact that these young people are interested in it is absolutely everything for the economic stability of Utah, because I don't think it's in, this is where I'll get into political trouble, house farms out in the South Valley where it's like these huge developments that, you know, don't make sense from a service standpoint of getting like actual power and water, and then they take eminent domain of actual farmland out there. I think it's more important to plan for agriculture, plan to protect those sort of things, and unfortunately right now I don't think it's being done to the extent that we need to do it. But I think with young people like that, the future's looking like it's going to keep getting better and better, and I think we're headed in a really good direction. I'd love to get in contact with those two incredible young women and see if they're interested in coming to a tasting class on us and delve down this rabbit hole of specialty food and excellent production practices even further. I think they'd be pretty into it, and it'd be our pleasure to do something like that for them. I think it'd be fun.
That's it. Congratulations. Great. On winning the healthiest meat.
That's awesome. Okay. The more that we promote it, I think the more that we can affect change in the broader marketplace. So it's a good thing. Yeah.
The students added purchasing grass-fed beef costs on average $1 to $3 per pound. And for now, they reassure us we are not being taken to the cleaners.
We would like to do special thanks to Luciano. He let us use his lab up at the University of Utah, and he gave us guidance of how to do things. And he was the one who did all of our mass spectrometer readings. And then Leslie weighed our samples. And then we'd like to thank Ms. Wickelson for supporting us and helping us, and then always taking us up there every day after school.
Are you proud of the results?
Oh, I think they've done a fantastic job. I am amazed at their, they have put in a ton of time in class, outside of class. They've been up at the university a lot, running samples up there. They were wicked smart kids to begin with, and now they're wicked, wicked smart kids, so.
All right, well, let's go.
Our next stop was down the hallway to hear about a corny study done by three middle school-age boys.
Hayden, Josh, and Jacob are looking at how much corn overall is in school lunch, and they've taken school lunch samples from a bunch of different schools, and they're comparing that to student preferences for taste. So corn is kind of an indirect measure of how processed our food is, because there's a lot of processed things that are actually made out of corn in general, and so they're kind of tracking that.
We believe that if we test the amount of corn in each of the school lunches we collected, that the school lunches that the kids favored the most would have more corn than the school lunches the kids favored the least, because based on studies, there's a lot of high fructose corn syrup in a lot of lunches. There's high amounts of cheap corn in the food, so if we're able to get that cheap corn in our bodies and we start to like it, we could expect to see that people like it more. Like, there's a lot of high fructose corn syrup sweetener in different foods, so people could find foods with corn in it more appealing than foods without corn.
The young scientists completed the analysis using the same methods as Jade and Jasmina described earlier, weighing and encapsulating the microsamples and examining the isotopes in the mass spectrometer, determining the amounts of carbon-13 and carbon-12 in their samples, ultimately revealing the healthiness of our food. And what did the boys find out? Well, their data for West High School lunch, including items such as a cheeseburger, macaroni and cheese, or chicken fajitas, showed all items tested in the C3 producer range, meaning there was a lot less corn in the lunches than their hypothesis suggested.
First, we gathered lunches from West High, our school, and Newman Elementary, and then we blended the individual school lunches, and then we froze them and labeled them, and then we went up to the U of U, and we freeze-dried the fruit, which is basically you freeze it, and then through sublimation, take out all the water. And then we grinded up the samples using a mortar and pestle.
The reason we're looking at these two ice tubs is because there's two types of plants, C3 producers and C4 producers, and corn is a C4 producer, which means it takes in both carbon-12 and a lot more carbon-13 than a C3 producer. And a C3 producer would be like wheat or rice or any grass. And so based on the ratio of C13 to C12 in your samples, you can tell how much corn is in it. The trend on this graph just kind of is flat. It doesn't have any trend at all, actually. And if our hypothesis was correct, you'd see one going from the shortest and to the tallest, from favorite lunches were more corny to least corny.
There's no correlation between favorite and least favorite lunches, and also they aren't very corny. So, yeah.
I'm not so sure if I missed this or not, but what part of corn makes it such a leading food and obesity causing?
It's the corn byproduct. What they make using the corn. So like high fructose corn syrup is a really big one.
Another thing is that it's just so much corn at such a cheap price. All the unhealthy foods are now less expensive than like vegetables. You can buy a $1 hamburger, but you can't even buy a head of broccoli for $1 anymore. It's just that corn prices have gone way down and all the other vegetables have gone way up because of being outcompeted. And so just corn's a lot cheaper because of overproduction.
So something we were pretty surprised about was that we kind of expected that we would see a lot of corn in school lunch, and that would kind of be a measure of school lunch is maybe having a lot of these processed additives. But really we found out that school lunch was pretty more in that C3 range. It didn't have as much of the carbon-13 isotope that we would have expected to see from corn. So that's great. It reflects well on school lunch. We also got a fairly tight data set. So the school lunches all fell within a fairly specific range in terms of the isotopes. And so something we decided to do was to test other lunches, fast food lunches or processed lunches from the store, to see what those ended up looking like comparatively. So we'll go out and we'll buy some Happy Meals and blend those all up in a blender. And then we'll look at the isotopes there.
And they did. Six of the students joined Wickelson for 2 weeks this summer to collect and prepare enough samples for publishable research comparing the carbon isotopes of school lunch and fast food. The students designed key elements of the experiment, picked apart some journal articles, wrote hypotheses, and picked some cherries along the way. Their samples are in line for the mass spectrometer, but haven't been analyzed yet. SQ Radio is on standby for the results to find out if fast food meals are chock full of corn products, and how fast food compares to school lunch. Sherry Quinn and Susie Montgomery reporting from Slixy.
It don't matter anyhow. Ain't no use to sit and wonder why, babe. If you don't know by now, when your rooster crows at the break of dawn, look out your window.
Teachers have the power to positively influence a student for the rest of their lives. It is a job that deserves respect and should not be taken lightly. Pat Shea, an associate research professor of biology at the University of Utah and a private practicing attorney, knows how impactful teaching is in all of our lives. And it would be an understatement to say Pat Shea's road to education is winding.
He started with a degree in intellectual history, attended Stanford, was a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford, where he studied genetics and animal behavior, and then got his law degree from Harvard.
I was the first in the family to go to college, and so my father's favorite question was, so let me get this straight, you're studying the history of ideas, and what kind of job is that going to get you? But that's what I did.
He has taught at Kansas State University, BYU, U of U, and Westminster. He was also head of the Bureau of Land Management during the Clinton administration and ran for Senate against Orrin Hatch in 1994.
Of all those jobs, where does teaching science fall? Where does being a professor fall?
If it paid enough to pay the mortgage, it would be the highest priority.
Professor Pat Shea is currently designing a course called Biography of an Urban Stream at the University of Utah that he will teach this fall, focusing on the Red Butte Canyon and using the oil spill in June of 2010, when an estimated 35,000 gallons of crude oil spilled from a fractured Chevron pipeline into the Red Butte Creek system.
Tell me about the course you've recently designed and what inspired you about it.
Well, I got a phone call in June when the first Chevron oil spill happened, and it was the Dean of College of Science, Pierre Sikorsky, who I've worked with for over 10 years. And he said, I think this is a teachable moment.
Pat Shea agreed. Lessons could be learned from the environmental insult of the Red Butte oil spill. He designed a course for upper undergraduate and graduate students with a twofold mission. The first to show students the integration between hydrology, biology, and geology, where students can see the scientific and mathematical tools that have proliferated in the last 10 years. The second goal of the class is for students to understand that the future in science is going to be multidisciplined and require the cooperation of public and private sectors. Essentially, no single entity is capable of solving these major environmental crises, and multiple organizations need to assume the responsibility for remediation rather than pointing fingers. He uses the BP oil spill as an example. In the classroom of Red Butte Canyon, Pat Shea will teach the students that managing wilderness from this holistic perspective is as important as managing our urban areas.
So if you go to the headwaters of Red Butte, you're at 9,500 feet, and you're amongst pine trees, conifers, and large snow and temperature variations. And then as you go down, and what this class is going to do is go down at 150 meters or 200 yards each class and examine what the flora is, both native and non-native, and how they're interdependent. I think a lot of times a person will see a tree or a bush or a grass, and they'll think of them simply in that species context. But there is an interdependency. So I'm hoping that the class will be a bit of a busman's tour through the world of science applied to a very specific geographic area that's literally in our backyard.
You've explained that we have so much information on the canyon. It's been studied since 1910. And now, why is this a teaching moment?
Well, I think it's a teaching moment because it brought people's attention in this information-cluttered world we live in on one particular place, Red Butte Creek. And I think that draws people's attention away from their routine. And for me, at least, those abnormal or unusual moments I remember more clearly than the normal moments. You know, you don't necessarily remember which glass you used to get a glass of water last night, but if you broke the glass, then you remember. And so I think this was, if you will, a broken glass moment that hopefully will get people more curious about their neighborhood, about the ecosystem that supports them.
Pat Shea may take the edge off a little by turning this devastating oil spill into a learning experience, not only for the students, but also for the community. Private entities, in this case Chevron, are still in partnership with Salt Lake Public Utilities and the university to refine their emergency handbook to one that is shared, where all parties remediate the damage as a team. Chevron staff, professors from the three science disciplines, and Public Utilities Director Jeff Niermeyer, whom Pat Shea refers to as a superb leader, will all be part of the class, providing students with an ongoing case study in both science and policy making.
Politics is the study of human dynamics, and I'm a firm believer that human dynamics are determined in part by the biology of the actors. You know, that just as the three-spined and ten-spined stickleback or the Rhode Island red chickens I studied had behavioral characteristics, or more importantly with my children, it is amazing to see the behavioral tics that you see in your kids that are hardwired. Part of the attraction to me about biology is scientific methodology is a intellectual rigor where you have to verify what you're asserting as your hypothesis. And I think all too often in politics, we assert things that are, upon critical examination, not true. Whereas in science, if they're not true, they're going to be proven to be not true. And in politics, we tend to let them float. So as I get older, I find more comfort in scientific methodology than I do politics. I always, when I teach, make it abundantly clear what my own political leanings are so that people will be able to calibrate what they're hearing to what they think they should be hearing. And I always invite opposing points of view because I think that's another instance, another teachable moment where there's conflicts of ideas and you as the listener have to ascertain who's telling the truth, who's not telling the truth, who do you agree with, who do you disagree with. And instead of just having sort of a monotone lecture, I'd much rather have a dialectic back and forth with the students.
Pat Shea has been a teacher for 36 years, and he has not only been a maverick in the educational arena, but in the political one as well. He served as head of the Bureau of Land Management under President Bill Clinton, has taken on many freedom of the press cases, and as a defense attorney for activist Tim DeChristopher, recently jailed for derailing a federal oil and gas leasing auction. Pat Shea vowed to appeal the sentence he called a serious abuse of justice. He fosters integrity and has always been looking around the corner, a natural curiosity he hopes to inspire in his students.
I grew up wanting to be Lewis and Clark, and exploring canyons as a kid was my form of recreation. My cousins and I would go up Mill Creek Canyon or up Little Cottonwood Canyon or up City Creek Canyon, and there was just always something around the corner. You know, there was another part of the stream, or there was a beaver pond, or there was, you know, a weasel or a muskrat or something, or there were birds that were fascinating. And to have people in the class share with me the enthusiasm for the natural setting, I think, will be what I'm searching for, and to hear their questions.
Science Questions is produced by Sherry Quinn and Susie Montgomery. Thank you for listening.
Support for Utah Public Radio comes from listeners and from the USU Department of Music's 8th Annual Jazz Night at the Sky Club. Benefiting the Larry Smith Jazz Scholarship, tonight and tomorrow with a silent auction and hors d'oeuvres, followed by dinner, big band music, and dancing. Information is at music.usu.edu.
This is KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.